Okay, so my name is Graham Reside. I teach at Vanderbilt Divinity School when I'm not at Holden Village. And I'm a sociologist of religion by training, but I also run a leadership program at Vanderbilt that works with professional students. So I have to work across the professional schools, but my home is in the Divinity School. And that makes for a kind of interesting work, because when you leave the Divinity School, and even in the Divinity School, but especially when you leave it in an urban university, you come across folks of all different faiths and perspectives. So it's a challenge and fun for me to think about how to talk to them about vocation, because that's really what I think leadership is. How to talk to them about the purposes of their lives in ways that are funded by my own religious convictions, but hopefully don't overwhelm them or don't fail to recognize their own religious sources. So I this week I'm working on values with you, and I use an instrument that is at the base of this talk and presentation today and tomorrow and Thursday, on values. That basically it's an online assessment. And the students go and they take this assessment, and it gives them a real, what I call a value signature. And we'll talk more about that. But it gives them a sense of what are the deep motivating values in their own lives. And it can be very illuminating for them, especially at their stage in life, because they're in professional school, so they're trying to connect up their vocation with their sense of meaning and purpose. So that's what's motivating me, because I think that's a conversation that is always worth having. So I have a couple of passages of scripture. In my estimation, all that we suffer in the present time is nothing in comparison with the glory that is destined to be disclosed to us. For the whole creation is waiting with eagerness for the children of God to be revealed. I picked this particular passage because this theory of values is a developmental theory. Okay? So it suggests that values change over the course of a lifetime. And the more we mature, develop, grow in our faith, the deeper our values become. And we'll see some of that. And I think this passage nicely points to that, as does this one. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. Okay, so I want to give you start out with a values theory overview, if that's all right. First, the way I'm using the term values is as representative of our deepest priorities, or for how we make and organize and make our way through life, the things that we are deeply committed to. That's probably fairly obvious. But here's a kind of formal definition. Values are ideals that give significance to our lives that are reflected through the priorities we choose and that we act on consistently. And here's another definition. Values are packets of energy and potential encoded in language. There are words that seem to really jazz us up. I'm not sure if that's the right verb there. But get us excited, enthuse us. Fill us with the Spirit. That's what enthuse is, right? Enthusiasm means to be filled with the Spirit. And these are encoded in language. The particular words activate for us a kind of energy, and we get excited around them. Other words, which may activate other people, have no energy for us, or very little energy. But for folks for whom they are a value, they activate. If you were at Kelton Cobb's discussion last night, he talked a lot about mana, this sense that in some things there is sacred value, and he talked about the mana that can be in. He talked actually about holding. This is an obvious symbol for Christians that has power. If you look upon the cross, it evokes for Christians a certain kind of power. But if you are not a Christian, it may not evoke that power at all. So particular words have in them, particular symbols have in them power for us. So there's a relationship between virtues and values. In some ways, values is just a social science, I'm a sociologist, so a social scientific word for the term virtues, more of an ancient tradition. But there are all, I argue that there are subspecies, because in most virtue theory, there's really only a handful of virtues. So Aristotle, who is sort of the father of virtue theory, had four virtues. Aquinas added faith, hope, and love to make the seven cardinal virtues. Okay? And I want to say virtues are those things that societies agree upon all people should have in order to have a meaningful life. But values are a broader range of possible goods, right, that we can be committed to. And so that I don't have a lot of values around music. I recognize it as a good, but I don't think it makes me a bad person. But there might be some societies in which musical skill and capacities are virtues and not just values. But there is that slight distinction between virtues and values.
Can you explain that a little bit more? I don't quite understand.
Okay, so
using music is a
that was a bad.
Well, no, it's not bad.
Yeah, I was trying to think of it.
It's something you don't. You're saying you don't know about it, so it's not.
Well, I just think it doesn't grab me. It's not one of those words that has a lot of energy, or not just words, but it's not one of those experiences that I'm no good at, too. That's the other reason. And I've been thinking about it because my kids are looking up to me, and I'm not Lutheran, I'm Presbyterian. So we go to Vespers, and they're looking up at me, and I'm mumbling. I don't know the words. I don't know the tune. I'm thinking, oh, I'm just such a terrible parent, because I'm not giving them the, you know, one of the ways you communicate virtues and values is by embodying them yourselves for your children. But the larger point is that values, in this theory that I'm using, this research, it's Hall Tona. Hall is a Catholic theologian, Tona is an Italian sociologist. They've gone around the world and they've identified 125 values. And they say there are 125 values in the world. But within those, each society selects a certain narrow number to say these are the real virtues. That you can't be a good person. The point of virtues is that you are a good person. These are the qualities of a good person. But there are some values that are great to have, but they don't define you as a good person. And we'll see them when I share all these values and say, oh yeah, that's a value, but not necessarily a virtue. It would be nice to have, but not necessary. But there are certain virtues that I want my children to have that's non-negotiable. I'm not sure piano lessons is one of those things. Yeah, this is a long story, but being forced to take piano lessons as a kid, and when I was no good at that, my mom pulled out the trombone, and I was no good at that, and she pulled out the guitar, thinking, well, you know, this is the 70s, maybe you'll like the guitar. But anyway, that's what I mean by substance. Okay, so our values are influenced by our inner world, so our own, you know, I just told you a little bit about my own family life. The kinds of just dispositions that I have, say, almost genetically. My sister's a great artist, and I'm not a bad artist. But anyway, I'm not a great artist. So there's a certain kind of internal, I think, disposition we have. But also, our culture gives us our values, right? Through the stories that we learn, and the institutions that we participate in teach us certain kinds of values. And finally, our relationships with one another. We learn values in those ways. As I said, Halton identified 125 values along a developmental map. I'll explain more about that. But they basically identify these 125 values, and then they put them on a trajectory. Right? So there are more simple, basic values, sort of more complex values, and then really higher values. And I'll share some of those with you. And they call it a value map. And in general, these values move from less complex to more complex. So at the far end, the left side of the map, which I might as well just hand out. I also have it on the PowerPoint, but you could just take one and pass it around. On the left side of the map, you have self-preservation. That's a fundamental value that people have. Or safety, right? Or sexual gratification. That is a basic value. But at the far right side of the map, you have global harmony. Right? So you can see the kind of trajectory from a kind of deep self-investment into my own, you know, interests, both physical and emotional, to a much broader sense. So at the far right is sort of issues of global harmony, ecology, and so forth. Everyone needs a map to know where we're going.
I'm lost.
Unlike most maps, the print is very small. Okay, so this is the map, okay? And Haltona argued that this map, you can see that there, I want to start at the top and then sort of work my way through, that the map represents four worldviews. And as you progress through life, and if things go well, that you sort of change your worldview. So phase, that's the phases, right? And in the first phase, you can imagine a young child. The world is a mystery over which I have no control. So this is, you know, maybe, I don't know, I'm going to say 0 to 8, maybe 10 years of age. There's a sense that the world is a mystery over which I have no control. And every once in a while, we feel that way. And the fundamental values here are self-interest, control, self-preservation. He talks about wonder, awe, and faith. Wonder at the kind of enormous mystery that is right in front of you. But you have no kind of agency to do anything to that mystery, so you just are in awe of it. The goals also, that on the second half, safety and security, there's sort of physical delight, security. And I'll talk about, as we go down a little later, but does that make sense? That the world is a mystery over which I have no control? And you can see how a young child might feel that way. It's also interesting to think in the evolution of religion, that primitive religions, or early religions, if I can use a less pejorative term, often see the world as a mystery to which they have no control. So all the gods are capricious, and you just want to get out of their way and not piss them off. So you sacrifice the chicken, you have the rights, whatever, to appease the gods, but you're never quite sure what they're going to do. So even in, it's a kind of pre-moral religious world. These are just powers that act upon you. But the gods are not necessarily good. They are just powers that act upon you. And we can even think of, it's a little more elaborated, but in the Greek tragedies, the world is a mystery over which finally Oedipus has no control, if we think about Oedipus. Right? That, and the gods are immediate. They're right there. They're just over the mountain. They're on Mount Olympus. Right? They're actually there. Right? It's not abstracted out into some heavenly realm. No, they're just around the corner. And a lot of, in Native Americans, the religious life is right embedded in the village or just on the other side of the trees. And their safety and survival really is much more up for them than ours is generally. So there, in this sort of first consciousness, the world is a mystery over which I have no control. And there's this particular, if you'll see, a set of values that go with that kind of worldview. So the values of self-interest, control, you want to be able to control the world the best you can. The goods of this life are, you know, making sure that making sure that you get fed, making sure that you stay alive. So the gods bless you with worldly goods. And in fact, in the sort of evolution of religion again, or early religions, don't really have a notion of an afterlife. It's the goodies rather than the good. So what are the goodies that I can get from these gods by keeping them happy? Okay, the second phase. The world is a problem with which I must cope. I've got an 8-year-old girl, and I think this is the kind of world that she lives in. There's, again, no sense of agency. There's a lot of rules, right? She's trying to figure out how the world works, but it's fundamentally a problem with which she must cope. I suppose I, too, am a problem with which she must cope. Trying to figure out, well, what does he want? What's he need? Probably less what I need. But what do I want? What are the rules here? How do I navigate this? How do I solve this problem? So there's a lot of problem solving at this stage. And what's up for them is a sense of belonging. And they can get lost in fantasy play, and what they really need is a sense of self-worth. That's what's developing over time. And I'll go into these goals a little more later, but I just want to get these phases. So these worldviews, and again, I think, at least for me, it makes sense as I watch my own children and think about my own life as a sort of development over the ways in which I think about the world. What is the world to me? So in phase three, the world is a creative project in which I want to participate. And this is late adolescence, early adulthood. Right? And so we can see some of the goals that get activated here, or some of the values. Equality, liberation. This happens. Art, beauty. So this is self-actualization. This is when you're trying to become a separate, autonomous person in the world. So being self is another sort of value that people have. Then the fourth phase is, so this is a kind of egocentric phase. You want to get your ego out into the world. This is who I am. I'm not my family. I'm not my parents. This is me. Me. And so you're working on competency. I think you'll find competency in one of these lists, but I'll probably, printing is small. You want to be able to show your value in the world. And then the final one is interdependence. And here the world is a mystery again, but it's not a mystery of which you have no control. It's a mystery for which you have some responsibility. It's a mystery for which we care, and the guy who developed this is on a global scale. So there's a sense that it's not just me and my family or me and my village that's a mystery to me. It's the world, the whole cosmos, all of creation. But it's not something that I just stand in awe of. The awe is still there, but I have a responsibility towards. So this is the kind of maturation process, I think, that is captured by four different worldviews. And you can think, you know, which worldview do you find most compelling? And also think, which worldview do you actually live in and out of most of the time? Okay, so there's 125 values according to Paul Tomey. I find that a kind of almost arbitrary number, but let's just say there's a lot. But each person, and I actually find this pretty interesting when I work with students, I think it's true, each person has a particular what I call value signature. Not only is it that they select only a handful of these values to really orient their life around, but even if you and I pick the same 12 values, if we hierarchize them or index them differently, our relationship to them is very different. So they also work with one another, these values. So there's a particular value signature, almost like a thumbprint or a fingerprint that you have, that every person has, that makes up their kind of moral sensibility in the world. Does that make sense to you? So everyone puts together values in their own unique way. And how they work together and are indexed gives shape to our lives. And finally, the values do not operate in isolation from one another. They form clusters that drive behavior. And again, our values come from our history, both large and small. By large and small, I mean by the institutions within which we live, the larger cultural patterns that we are subjected to or participate in, but also by our unique sort of ego development and family life and the particular needs that went unmet or needs that really went fully met in our lives. Okay, so next I want to go to the importance of values. When we give this instrument, you saw there's 125 values on your sheet. Most people identify 55 to 65 values from their map. Yeah, these are, I get that. I'm interested in that. So as I said, if there's a value about music, it's probably, it may not make my map. Or if it does, it's one of the last ones I pick. But I'm not going to pick all 125. I'm probably only going to pick 55 or 65. And this is what the norm is. So this assessment has been given to tens of thousands of people. And the norm is most pick between 55 and 65 as, you know, these are words that really capture their imagination. But they only operate from a core group of 15 to 20. So then within that larger group of values, there's only 15 to 20 that are really important for them, and they only focus on 4 to 6 on any given day. Yes?
Do people who have a deficiency in identification with values, is that aberrant and indicate like an indication of maybe social path or something like that? Or?
Yeah, I do think that if certainly younger students that I have are
less articulate. I mean, one of the things about growing up or developing is developing a broader range of language. If you have no words for things, it's hard to really capture the value. So one of the things I try to do is draw them out. You know, well, okay, so as I say, guesses count, you know. But if people are really unable to name values, I find it sad. They live in a very narrow world. They typically live in a very narrow world. Now, that doesn't mean that they're sociopathic, because they may be able to only name a handful of values, but they're ones that we respect and admire in some way. But they still don't have a full range of life, I would want to suggest. But I would get worried if they just picked really basic values.
I mean, if they were living in a world that was really distressing all the time, right, that they would probably be, I mean, it might be appropriate that they're living in a world of safety.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
You need that in order to get to the higher level.
I mean, one thing we talked about last week, I talked about human development more generally, psychological, faith, moral, and cognitive development last week. And it is true that some people, and it's on this slide actually, further down, if they're under a lot of stress, they can focus really on the sort of left side of the values map, or in last week's language, the left side of development. But it's also true that our range of responses is more narrow. So children tend to fight or flight, and when adults behave at this end, they tend to rage more. They don't have a fine or distinguished emotional register. They've got one response, and it's violence, and it's rage, and sometimes violence. So I do worry that if people are really here, if they are under a lot of stress, they're more likely to become violent. And I think we can see this around the globe at any one time. As I've said repeatedly here, the alternative is to think we're better than they are when we see people do things that are just atrocious to one another. But if we think, no, they're living in conditions that are pressing them to the left side of the map, they're more likely to act in violence. Is that okay? So here's just some other. The research indicates that people are actually unconscious of 70 to 90% of their values. So it is the exercise actually asks them to articulate, and most of them find it kind of fun and interesting. But we're unconscious until we're asked to think about it. We can't just name it. Part of the reason that we give them the definition so that they can read it and say, oh yeah, that's interesting to me. They're not going to come up with global harmony on their own. So bringing values to consciousness, especially vision values, which I'll talk about in a minute, I think greatly accelerates our learning and growth, or at least it's a means by which we can continue to develop. Because we can decide, oh, yeah, okay, so those are my values. I'd like to think about these other values on the map as well. Okay. So this goes to the type of values. There are three types of values that were up on that map and are in the map in your hand. One is the foundation values, focus values, and vision values. Now, next slide, we'll break them up. So the focus values are those value priorities in our day-to-day lives that describe our present worldview, our criteria for decision-making, our attitude towards relationships, and the focus of most of our energy. So those are the 10 to 15 or 15 to 20 that, no, no, those are the 4 to 6 that we actually deal with day in, day out, that we're focusing on. You know, so for me, for a long time, when I was in graduate school, it was about sort of establishing expertise and competency. That was on my mind a lot, right? As a parent, there's a certain set of values that are on my mind just by the nature of my life. I can't be thinking about global harmony when I'm thinking about changing the diapers. Okay. So these are our focus values, the ones on the map that are kind of in the middle. But focus values need vision values to give them purpose. Right? So part of this storyline on this map that you're looking at is there's a connection across the value map that our focus values should be driving towards the vision. The vision values are luring us. Yeah, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about them, but if we spend no time thinking about the vision and purpose of our lives, then the activities that we're engaged in day in, day out can seem like just changing the diapers. But if I'm thinking, no, I'm trying to develop this child into a person who can be an agent in the world for good, you know, then that connects my diaper changing to a vision for my child. And it actually makes diaper changing a little easier. stinks less. Do you believe that? No? Okay, these are the foundation values. And this is the slide I was talking about. These represent our basic needs and are the foundation for being able to act on and live out our focus values. So if our basic foundational values are not being met, we spend a lot of energy and time on those values, right? And we can't focus on the focus values or our vision values as effectively. So one of the lessons of this theory or of this research is, let's not pretend that we don't have basic values and ignore them. Because if we ignore them, we can't spend our time on these other things. We keep reverting back trying to get our basic needs met, whether it's survival or a sense of belonging or a sense of self-worth. So it's important to attend to our basic foundational values. So foundational values particularly come out for us during times of crisis or stress. And this is the sentence that I was trying to raise up earlier. The people who are habitually stressed can live their whole life in this way, where they feel like they're always putting out fires. They're always trying to just get those basic needs met. I should stop saying they here. When we, or me, feel that way, you know, that you just feel like your life has no purpose. You really start to feel like your life has no purpose if all you're doing is chasing after your foundational values. So shore up the foundations, one of our. There's no shoulds, but it's a good idea. And at least look for cracks, right? Where are you likely, where's the foundation in your life likely to get shaky? And all you need to do usually is look back on your history. When have I been under enormous stress, or when have I felt that my life is, when have I been depressed, and what were the things that were up for me at that time? Was it that I didn't have a good sense of my vocation? I wasn't clear where I was going. I mean, it could be a whole range of things. But to think about your foundation, these values can kind of indicate what those are. Finally, vision values. And these are really, I think, promising. They represent the motivational force in our life. They lure us or call us forward. We're not there yet. We don't spend all our time. Very few people spend all their time, their focus attention, at the vision on the right-hand side of the column. And, you know, that can be depressing. I mean, I believe in environmentalism. I believe in social justice. I believe in global harmony. I don't work for those things day in, day out. But hopefully they're calling me forward. And that in some ways, at least the attention that I do give to my focus values is organized or oriented toward these deeper vision values. I like the word seduction. So they seduce us to come with them. Come on. The water's good over here. Whoops. Okay. So I'm interested to know your response to this. I have some other things we can do when I get back. Yes.
The list is quite extensive, and I try to go back in my own childhood and think of things I saw from my parents or my, and I saw, you know, tending more of what we call it altruism. With my own parents, it was, I saw a lot of the stuff to the right side in gestures, more than let's say, than in sitting down and looking at a book of rules and internalizing them. And it almost seems, if you're going to go with 125, it's almost an intellectual exercise in review. How can you possibly, when you get farther to the right, you actually have to have, in my mind, less to reflect on and more to move on to. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be modeled for you. It's got to be modeled for you. Somebody has to teach you that. Mm-hmm. And for me, gestures are the most important. But I think you can look back, but to look at that and then say, I'm going to envelop this and make a list, it almost looks like a list of, there's too many, I've got an excuse here not to move forward.
Right. Well, I think I understand what you're saying, but what you said, gestures, tell me a little more about that.
Well, I mean, I grew up in a family with a very handicapped sister who had polio, and there was a lot of, and my dad was a public community organizer, and there were just a lot of things that were just done in self-sacrifice through gesture that were quiet, and things that I think sort of, when I act, I don't really think. I more just like try to feel what's right.
Right.
And I mean, maybe having a background like that makes it easier than for somebody else. It doesn't mean I can't be impulsively angry either.
Sure.
But I can't see carrying a list like this around in my pocket. It seems like you're lost if that's what you're gonna do.
No, so what I try to, well, what the assessment does is it captures students, whoever I'm dealing with. It asks, you know, probably 100 questions,
uh-huh.
And they self-identify the foundational ones that are up for them,
uh-huh.
And others get left off because they're just not up for them.
Sure.
And then it talks about their handful, so it actually only identifies, you know, 15 to 20,
mm-hmm.
with maybe 3 or 4 in the foundational, most in the focus, and a few in the vision. So it allows them to get clear about what they care about and that storyline. So yeah, I would not want anyone to think that these 125 values are the map. No, it's your particular identification of the words that turn you on that is your map. And can you then connect your vision values to your focus values? One of the challenges for students is they go so quickly to vision values but there's no means, I should say. This is another, I think, helpful distinction. There are goals that we have. So some values are goals in this theory. But some values are means for achieving those goals. And if you have these goals, right, goal values, but have no means values, then it leads to frustration. So we can just think here, if the goal on this end is self-interest and control, how do you get that? Well, you learn certain... let me go to self-preservation. If it's self-preservation, you learn certain skills for staying alive in the wilderness or in your family, whatever is the violent possibility. You learn how to get food, stay warm, manage shelter. So there's this sort of relationship between goal values and vision values. But here, if we think over here, here's competence. Under 4, under goals, you can have competence is your goal value. But if you have no plan, like so here, it's as simple as education and certification. Right? You have to be able to display and deploy your competency in a particular way. So I do find this also a helpful kind of distinction between goal values and means values. And especially for students who are really, often we get so far out on the vision that we can't think about how to achieve those visions in the world through means values. But the larger issue is to sort of identify what are the things in your life that are up and how do they connect to the vision in your life. So I handed out these definitions because I find some of these terms rather opaque. Does everyone have a definition sheet?
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
Do you think with this, my husband and I were talking a couple weeks ago, he's a police officer, so he encounters a lot of people who are going through basic needs kinds of goals, and we were talking about how it seems like there's a lot of people who are kind of an adult body but are very childlike in the way that they behave and the way that they interact with other people. And I wonder if people, if you know, say you're in your 30s and you're still working on food, warmth, and shelter, how easy is it for them to, I mean, is it realistic that people who are stuck at that age, in that phase, to get past that,
I'm a sociologist and a social ethicist, and I would say no, it's not possible. And that's why we have this responsibility to ensure that the world or our social institutions are set up in such a way that we don't allow people to fall through the cracks. Because yes, the exceptional person can claw their way up, but when all your attention is focused on the left side, I mean, that's where it should be. If your very safety and survival is at stake, or let's say you're a single parent and it's hard to find a good job, that your the safety and survival and the well-being of your family is at stake. I don't think they're going to show up for an environmentalist meeting. And I think that's reasonable.
Or if their addiction, you know, would keep people in that first phase, you know, because they're just, they're not able to check out, you know, thinking day to day.
I mean, one of the most profound experiences I had was when my wife was going to take the GRE to go to graduate school, right? So we had just been to Princeton Seminary, and we were going on to do PhD work. And we were living in Atlanta, and the GRE was being offered at Southwest Atlanta High School, which is in a predominantly African-American neighborhood and economically depressed. And so I'm waiting in the hallway, and someone comes up and says, because she's just taken, I thought I'll just hang out. She's taking the GRE, which is a graduate record exam. It's like the SAT for grown-ups. And they asked me, will you proctor the SAT? And I'm a sociologist, so I'd already walked around the school. And what I noticed was there was not one poster for a college, but there was a lot of posters for the military. Okay, I get that. But that's interesting data. Then I go and I sit in this GRE room, the SAT room, and I watch, and these kids are, my job was to tell them not to open their newspaper. You know, and I remember taking it. You're going to the last second trying to fill it out, right? They're not interested. They're not even taking it. But it's not because they're, my assumption or my interpretation, it's not because they're stupid. It's because they know why. I'm not going to college. You know, if I got in, where would I go? I mean, we have no means in my family, so they don't even try. And then their scores are terrible, right? Because they're not even giving their best effort. So they're already subjected to probably a lousy educational system compared to what my kids get. And then they don't even try, because it would be a little unreasonable to try. So I found that a really shocking experience for me as an insight into the way in which our social institutions set some people up for failure. Now, of course, it was also interesting that there was one kid that was just busting, and I could see it every the time would go by and we'd have to tell him, okay, stop, put it down. She's an immigrant kid, right? Clearly an immigrant kid. She's got a different story, right? She doesn't have the same sort of history of failure and the failure of our institutions. So she hasn't quite bought into or accepted that she can't do it yet. So that was interesting to me too. And that's not about race for me, but about class and about institutional arrangements. And it just so happens that in that situation it was largely African American. I think that tried to answer a question somebody asked me. But it was a conversion experience, so it was a testimony, if nothing else. Okay, so what does someone talk about time?
7:30.
Okay, so we have a few more minutes. So what I'd like you to, I've given you the definitions, and then I'll hand out this sheet, and I'd like you to just for kicks, try to identify some things that you think are interesting. Look at the definition. Yeah, and try to pick one from each area. One thing that you find yourself spending time on in your focus, in your foundation, one thing you spend time on in your foundation, got that wrong, foundation, focus, and then one vision, maybe one or two vision things that capture you. That's pretty cool. And if you're having trouble, think about, well, who are your moral heroes? Are they, is it Bishop Tutu? Is it MLK? Is it, you know, is it your father, your mother? What is it about them, of your moral heroes, that you can identify in that last vision phase? So I'll hand this out. So it asks you to just identify one each, and I'll give you a couple minutes to do that. And then, if you don't mind, and if you're up for it, share with one other person your foundation value, your focus value, and your vision value. And again, you haven't taken the assessment, so this is just a sort of self-selection from the variety of possibilities here. Thank you. Anyone need one? And in the interest of not wasting paper, I put other stuff on the back of everything, so.
Could you be just slightly more clear on, if I look at this chart and this, what I'm talking about in terms of foundation value, focus value, and vision value?
Oh, I'm sorry. So the foundation values, if you look at this here, are basically through here.
And you're going up, okay.
Right, going up. And then there's two kinds of foundational values, goals and how you achieve those goals. And if these values don't work for you, but you can think of something else that would fit generally in this schema, just write that down. And then your focus values are through here. And you really need to, I think, consult the dictionary to get some of these, what they actually mean. And then finally, the vision values are from basically here over. At the back.
Is there a third page?
That page
you just
came up. You didn't get that? Sorry. It's called a values-based exercise. You don't have that?
You don't have that.
I'd just like to spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes thinking about how you would identify yourself on this map, just in terms of three values. Maybe sharing with somebody else, and then I'll sort of collect or bring us together at the end and just chat for a minute. So can I interrupt, or is it too soon? Did I hear something too soon? Oh, I can interrupt? Okay, so does anybody have any that they'd like to share, what a foundational value was for them? How about a focus value? What are you focusing on?
I'll do a foundation.
Okay.
I picked wonder and curiosity.
Uh-huh.
And as a kid growing up, our family did a lot of traveling throughout the United States, and I just found a lot of wonder and awe of both nature and the beauty of this country, whether it's national parks or landscapes or views, and also a lot of wonder and curiosity over big cities and sort of the complexity and messiness and excitement and hustle and bustle of big cities.
Did you have a focus value?
I had efficiency and planning.
Uh-huh.
And that was more, I think, being interested in doing a lot of different things and knowing that in order to experience different things, it was going to have to be organized.
And not to put you on the spot, but did you have a vision one?
Vision, I had community and personalist.
Uh-huh.
And I actually had sort of a sports analogy there. I was a runner in high school and college, cross country and track. So you very much, you have your own event that you're doing. You're trying to achieve a personal best, but you're part of a larger team that's depending on you to do well.
Right.
So you have your sort of own personal goals, which are part of the team environment.
Well, one thing that's fun, I didn't give you much time to do this, but the people have time and are thoughtful, and then they just share three, their foundational, their focus, and their vision values. And then they kind of guess what kind of line of work they're in. I have no idea what you do. I have not, from that. But from the beginning, from the wonder, awe, and faith one, I wondered if you're, it's an easy call, holding, but in religious life, or in some kind of arts, in the arts in some way. But that was just from the first one. But sometimes there's an obvious thread and through the three that you can sort of guess at least. So what is it you do?
I work in city planning and public policy.
Uh-huh. And so your focus value is particularly made sense.
Trying to make a city a better place for everyone that lives there.
Another way to think about this that can be fun is to think, if you think about, there's four worldviews, right, that we all have within us at any time. What percentage of your life do you think you spend thinking the world is a mystery over which I have no control, or the world is a problem with which I must cope, the world is a creative project in which I want to participate, or the world is a myth, just think of, am I 25% in each, am I 50% in one, or am I spending most of my time in the world is a problem with which I must cope? Like April 15th, maybe you spend a lot of time in the world is a problem with which you must cope. Does anyone else have a value package they can share? Yes?
And looking at it, and as you were analyzing it, I thought I could come up with one word that actually brought the three together, which is kind of interesting, because I, as a foundation value, I had security.
Mm-hmm.
And because I feel like you can't do a lot unless you feel secure. It's very important to people. And a focus value was integration or wholeness, which still kind of leans back into that whole security part. And then truth or wisdom as a vision. And the one word that I could use to describe all three of those is trust.
Mm-hmm.
Just having trust in everything. If you have trust, then you can do all of those things.
Right. And another thing that shows up on these assessments is a gendered division of value labor. I don't think it goes to the nature of things so much as the institutional nature of things. But maybe, there's an argument to be made. No, it goes to the nature of things. That the baby suckles at the mother's breast, and
No amount of social arrangement can change that. But I also think, you know, that it's also part of our society. So women become the custodians of trust, right? That they're the ones that build trust in relationships. But whether that's by nature or nurture, that's another question. Yes?
Do more women choose security than as a
yes.
Yeah, because that was my foundation. But it was embarrassing to put it. I wanted to be able to say something else.
Right. But you think, I mean, again, if we think of the long history of humankind, that the security of the hearth has been the responsibility of women. The men went out and killed the game, or did the hunting. Yeah.
See, I was wondering about some of them, especially under the institution, because some of those are kind of ones that I try to push back, but they keep pushing on me, and I'm, you know, I guess I'm thinking of things like competition and achievement and things of that nature. And some of them, you know, my foundational goals are security and shelter. We're dealing with a lot of house issues at the moment. And I want to get to some of the higher order things, but those things, and especially in the institutional line, keep on knocking on me. And I don't necessarily want to go there, but it's sort of like those values that come from the outside that push on you. Those are the ones that are, I'm struggling with.
Well, I do, what I don't want this instrument to do is, or this presentation, is to serve as a kind of judgment that I'm not spending more time up here. Yeah. And the assumption is we would all like to spend more time up here. So what do I need to take care of? I mean, it's actually a kind of caretaking tool. What needs, clarifying what needs to be taken care of in order for me to be more fully living out my vision values. I also thought it was interesting that, so in some ways it's episodic what your focus values are, because there's a housing issue up now, you said. But presumably that's not up all the time.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. No, we have a house, but I mean, it's it's just, it's a big one right now.
Right.
It's a big one right now, yeah. So, I mean, it will be taken care of.
Yeah. And some of the big ones in my life right now are 3 and 8 years old, and that's also going to change over time. Anyone else want to put out their some of their values? Yeah.
I would get this surprise looking at this list, but how important under the focus value for me ritual is, and that it's actually somehow linked back to community and family, security, ritual, and beauty. I don't know how those all come together, but that's what really attracts me. Art, he doesn't say beauty, does it? Yeah, art and beauty and ritual and security. That is, those things don't seem to hang together, but those are the words that.
Really? Because they hang together. They hang together for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, security ritual is a way of. In my own, okay, so I tell tales about my wife all the time when she's not here. She grew up in the mission field, in tents. She was born in the mission field, grew up in the mission field. There was a divorce early. She's very concerned about having order for our life, ritualized order, because security was up from a very early stage. So there's a kind of ritualizing where security wasn't up for me, and I'm hard to live with, apparently. because there isn't this sort of attention to, I just take it for granted that the world will be ordered, and actually I depend upon other people doing it for me. But because no one did it for her, she's attentive to doing it for her kids and for her. So I do think it, at least, and then even beauty. There's a sense of beauty is a kind of harmony. What could be seen as a kind of harmony?
When I think of ritual, I don't think of just doing things in an ordered way. I think of somehow small things carrying huge meaning. And now I'm thinking it's because at the age of 4, I was abandoned by my mother, who didn't mean to abandon me. She just got polio and had to ship me off. And so I wonder if it's sort of because that was, as you say, a new phrase, up for me, security was up for me, for maybe strangers, because she couldn't care for me. So that's a kind of a revelation. But for ritual, I don't just mean order, I mean something. This whole making of meaning and beauty, and which I think binds us. It's both hospitable and so this is very interesting. But I don't have anything, you know, I don't have any global visions, which right. is distressing. Right. I think I'm domestic. Domesticated in my vision.
Huh? Our beauty are fairly global.
They don't reach out to the very end.
Yeah. Well, there, I sometimes, it's very hard when the theory at the far right gets attenuated. It's very hard for me to have a relationship with an abstract and global other. Mm-hmm. Right. But I do think some folks are able to see, so Bishop Tutu, for example, he was on campus at everywhere at the school. And, yeah, you're really his brother or sister, despite the huge cultural and historical and gap, and the gap in the amount of suffering we've done. He's still, you do get this sense. So I guess I value it, but I also am a little nervous about this notion, because we hold, because it's really hard to love an abstract global other. Yeah.
I think for people who spend a lot of time down there, there's somebody who takes care of the things on the other end, though. You know, you think of somebody like Martin Luther King or somebody. He could not have done what he did up front on the far right if there hadn't been other people taking care of those other things. He could not get there because there was probably not balance.
Right. I think I have, and you know that he had foundational issues. Right. He did. I mean.
Yeah.
Snuck around to get them met, I mean, like we all do. I want to end, I think I just have a couple minutes, with two things. No, we don't all do that one. All I'm saying is we all find a way to get our needs met. we don't all do that. Okay. I find this kind of interesting too, this kind of different levels of different ways of leading. This is a leadership. So people that are living, when they think of the world as a mystery, then they look to authoritarian leadership, right? And the authoritarian leader emerges in that stage. And you may know this type of person. Knowledge is data, so their power is in withholding knowledge from you. And again, I studied religion, so if you think about the history of religion, how sort of the secrets that only the religious experts were allowed to know, right? Because their power is in their authority is in their ability to monopolize knowledge. Okay, the next one is sort of benevolent. This is the benevolent king, right? So security is still up a little bit. Family, as long as we have a king who is a paternalistic ruler, we're happy. Here is, the manager. This is bureaucratic life, institutional bureaucratic life. Knowledge is information. They're trying to share. The manager is trying to keep everyone in the loop, right? So this is leadership by management. And then you can see, as at least to me, these are better or more rewarding forms of leadership. The next one is facilitator. So they are mentoring you and facilitating your own growth. And then collaborator, servant, leader, right? And then the last one, dynamic matrix. Maybe no one ever call me that. But I think what this is indicating is that it's a bunch of leaders. At the global level, Bono can't do it alone. Tutu can't do it alone. But they work together. There has to be this sort of together. But they're leaders. They're not managers. They're leaders working together.
Sort of a sharing of power.
Uh-huh. A sharing of power, but at the level of leadership and not just management.
Right.
Yeah. I found that interesting. So thanks for letting me try this out. It wasn't obvious. This is the first time I've tried this out for a while. And it's really rich. Just this one slide, I could have spent the whole time on. Yes?
That lower level, is that still in the same vein as the upper one? The politics fear-driven and security-driven?
Yeah, it's the same idea, right?
Are you still talking about leadership stuff?
So we can think, when our self-preservation is up for us, or when the state is overpowering,
then our politics is fear-driven. I would suggest or propose that lately our politics has been security-driven. And we, you know, I mean, is Barack Obama going to be able to appeal to, I'm a Democrat. But is Barack Obama going to be able to appeal to people if what's really up for them is security, right? I think, you know, global life, partnering, you know, that may excite people with Obama. But if it's this kind of primitive or primeval need that is up for people, and I just watch what code we go to before the election.
At least it's a step up from fear-driven.
Sorry?
It's a step up from fear-driven, which is, I think we spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, I actually do think we're ready. I mean, it seems like most Americans are ready to. Okay, yeah, it was reasonable for us to be all anxious and fear-driven, but it's been 6 years, 7 years. Let's see if we can start to move on. All right, thanks a lot. Tomorrow we'll work more on our own particular individual groups tomorrow.